Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, storm clouds are gathering over Lady Gaga's new album, Art Pop. And live music in our studio from the Australian musician and producer known as Chet Faker. Yes, Faker. But first, I want you to step inside the Soundcheck time machine. Yes, the Soundcheck time machine is an old Ford Econoline tour van, and yes, the tires are bald. You were expecting maybe a DeLorean. Anyway, I want to take you back, way back, to a time when new ideas were flowing like wine. Music was shedding its inhibitions, and revolution was in the air. Wait, hold on. Folks, obviously the Soundcheck time machine is still in beta testing, and one of the bugs we're trying to work out is this thing. Every time you say, revolution was in the air, this... See? There you go. Hendrix, again. Somebody put that thing back in the garage. We'll deal with the time machine later. I want to talk about 1989, the year a British guy floated the idea for something called the World Wide Web. Revolution was in the air in Eastern Europe, and for just a moment, the future of music sounded like this. If you're of a certain generation of rock fans, those few seconds of the song She Bangs the Drums might just trigger a wave of nostalgia. The band was the Stone Roses. They exploded out of Manchester, England with this self-titled debut album, and then almost as quickly imploded in a morass of legal wrangling and personality clashes, leaving their fans to wonder what might have been. Well, last year, the band embarked on an improbable reunion tour. It's the subject of a new documentary, The Stone Roses, Made of Stone. It's in limited release here in the States, comes out on DVD on December 3rd, and the film's producer, Mark Herbert, joins us on the line from the UK. Mark, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi there, hi, how are you?
So give us a sense of why The Stone Roses cut such a big swath through the music scene in the UK.
I was 18 when that album came out, and, you know, a big music fan, and not just sort of chart music, but all kinds of music. I had some great, older friends and cousins who used to go around and listen to vinyl at their house, and somehow there was a movement of what the Roses defined was this kind of, it felt indie, like indie music, but it had this kind of new dance groove and a bit of funk, and it kind of exploded at a time when I think that the music scene in the whole of the UK changed. And I think the Roses kind of spawned a lot of new music. So it was a time when, I mean, guys went from kind of fighting in nightclubs to dancing together in nightclubs within a year. You know, there was this crazy time where, you know, and everybody, you know, people started to get kind of baggy jeans and the haircut, and there was a kind of real belonging. And it was great that it didn't come out of London. It came out of the north of England. And I think that was a lie. A lot of people jumped on it and felt, you know, a lot of people just hung on to this band and what they spoke for. And there was a beautiful poetry about the lyrics as well, I think a lot of people connected with.
Let's hear a little bit of the music from that debut album by the Stone Roses. In fact, they didn't wait long to make a great first impression. This is the lead-off track called I Wanna Be Adored.
I
Stone Roses and their lead-off track from their self-titled debut album in 1989, I Wanna Be Adored. The Stone Roses are the subject of the documentary The Stone Roses Made of Stone, produced by Mark Herbert, who's on the line with us from the UK. And Mark, how difficult was it when the Stone Roses somewhat surprisingly announced that they were getting together for a reunion tour? How difficult was it to get this film made? To get their approval and cooperation.
Well, it was a crazy journey for myself and the director Shane Meadows. We knew Shane and me were big fans of the band, and the lead singer Ian Brown had played a cameo in. He was a big fan of a lot of the films we've done, the past the drama, and we had him in as a cameo role in a TV series, and we kept in touch, and he. He rang Shane. We were just editing the last episode of a drama, and we were on our way to a film festival in France, and he rang Shane to tell Shane that they were getting back together, Shane's favourite band, which was amazing. And then the second thing was, would we be able for filming it?
So
there was no way we couldn't make the film.
So
you know?
He and called so I guess, you. He called you and said, will you make this film about us?
Yes, and we hit it. We found we got on well with the band. They let us into the rehearsals. And at least for me and Shane, the worst thing that could happen is that we'd get to see them live because we both missed them. For us, it was a big excuse just to see them live.
All right. So the resulting documentary, The Stone Roses, Made of Stone, directed by Shane Meadows, produced by Mark Herbert, who's on the line with us. And joining me in the Soundcheck studio is our old friend Jeff Gordonier, New York Times staff writer, author of 2008's X Saves the World, among other things. Jeff, good to have you back.
It's always good to be here. Thank you.
We can hear the enthusiasm still in Mark's voice.
Yeah.
And all his family and friends so enthused about this band. Why was the reaction much more muted here in the States?
Well, first off, Mark said the key phrase there, which was, I was 18 when the album came out.
Uh-huh.
That's a pivotal phrase for so many of us with so many bands. You know, for me, I'm thinking of REM. And for an American audience, we saw that enthusiasm sort of sweeping, you know, through the press coming out of England. And for those of us who were paying attention, it sounded fantastic. There was this whole idea of Manchester, the city of bloom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody romantically wants to be part of a movement. And as you can hear in the music of the Stone Roses, there is this sweep, this epic sweep to it when they were at their best.
You mentioned Manchester.
Yeah.
The play on the city of Manchester. Stone Roses, they were, and maybe Mark, I should direct this question to you, they were sort of the emblematic figures of Manchester, weren't they?
Oh, very much so, yes. They really... There was a movement in Manchester, warehouse parties, and they were part of that scene. And so both musically, they... I mean, you know, the amazing relationship between Manny, the bass player, John Squire's amazing guitar, and Rennie, the drummer, there's this incredible funk, and, you know, we'd never heard anything like that before. And it really fused a lot of genres together. And I think what happened was that a lot of bands, if you listen to bands that came out a year after that, 2 years, three, four, five, it was all really, you could really identify the Stone Roses as a big influence on that.
I think that's a really interesting point in terms of their sound, because they had this shimmer of psychedelia, they also had this snarl of punk rock. I mean, the lyrics are actually very dark and often very angry. And then they also incorporated dance music, which was a brilliant stroke. I mean, one of their great singles was Fool's Gold, which is just a great dance song. And so they
and epic dance length, too. I mean,
it's
on
like
the
10
record,
minutes
it's
long.
Almost 10 minutes.
Yeah, 10, 11 minutes long. And they did that just as rave culture was blossoming. You know, they had this darkness and the shimmer at the same time. So it was very romantic. And, what happened, it's also romantic, is their failure. They essentially squandered the moment. They probably could have conquered the States, but they botched it. They put out this masterpiece and essentially vanished into this, you know, quagmire of tedium and just basically didn't make any new music for years. In the meantime, a little band called Nirvana came along mm-hmm. with a whole different movement from Seattle. All these other bands, Mudhoney, Pearl Jam, Alice in Chains. And actually, a few years after that, a little band called Oasis from Manchester,
right.
who had been inspired by the Stone Roses in the first place. So in a sense, they made themselves obsolete.
They had a moment, and they didn't grab it.
But in a way, you know, I got to say, in their defense, I have a special place in my heart for bands like the Sex Pistols, the Cowboy Junkies, the Laws, Neutral Milk Hotel, whom I associate with one true masterpiece. Now, the band might actually put out many more mm-hmm, records, as mm-hmm. the Cowboy Junkies did, and beautiful ones, but to me, it's all about the Trinity Session. With the Stone Roses, there's something kind of lovely and magic about the fact that it was all encapsulated in a few months,
yeah.
and it was powerful, and then they just ruined it.
Now, Mark,
it's very rock and roll. I mean, that's in some ways
it is
more
a classic
rock and roll.
Rock and roll
it's the
story,
same with the
yeah.
Sex Pistols. It's just very rock and roll. This kind of implosion and self sabotage.
Mark, there's a big section of your film that deals with the reaction of fans to the Stone yeah. Roses getting back together. You know, first gig of the reunion, which we're going to play. Now, set this up for us. It was announced the morning of the day, right, on BBC Radio.
They put months of effort into the rehearsals. We were there, and we filmed it. And then they wanted to play to an audience, and they could have sold the tickets for thousands of pounds because it was a small venue. It was 1,200 people, and they decided that what they would do was announce it at 4 p.m. The gig was at 7:30. The social network, Twitter and Facebook, went crazy, and they basically said the first 1,200 fans that turn up with genuine memorabilia, an old vinyl cover, no. a ticket stub, anything from the past, anybody who turned up, the first 1,200 people were getting to the show for free. And so we wanted to try and make a section of the film where it didn't really matter if you were into the Stone Roses or not. It was about belonging and feeling a belonging and excitement about a band. And so what we did was really quite a bold decision from Shane, was to take 20 minutes of the film and not have the band in it and just concentrate on the euphoria and frantic chaos outside a venue as thousands of people turned up.
I'll go running down the street with kids under their yeah. arms and
with
stuff.
There's nothing like the frantic chaos of 40-year-old
yeah.
men.
And there was lots of 40-year-old men, you know, with the kid. And if you saw from the gig, and you mentioned Oasis before, that one of the people that was in the that turned up at that gig and who actually, quote, in the film said that the best band to ever come out of Manchester was obviously Liam Gallagher from Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a special moment. And to me, that was still the most defining gig I've ever seen. Even though we were working, I've never heard 1,200 people sound so loud, sound so euphoric.
And these are some of the fans, as we hear them in the documentary film The Stone Roses Made of Stone.
Why are they so important to people? Why are they so special?
You know and I know, but you can't write it down, can you? Well, these lot know. Everyone knows. Tattoos. You know, there's a reason why I've still got my hair like this, like, 20 years later, you know what I mean? There's a reason why I've never worn a tie. There's a reason why I listen to that album at least once
okay.
a week.
You know, you get an album or a band of songs or whatever, and you have it with you, don't you? Especially if they've split up for years. So you play it when... play it when you have a great time, you play it when people pass on, play it when you get married, play it when your kids are born. And honestly, I was in pieces then. When they started Made of Stone, I went to bits. I just never thought I'd hear it. And I know, I don't want to be philosophical or anything, but it makes you feel good that further down the line things come good.
So those are some of the fans of the band The Stone Roses. During the reunion tour, the unexpected, unanticipated surprise reunion tour of 2012 by the groundbreaking UK band. The documentary is called The Stone Roses Made of Stone, available on DVD on December 3rd, currently in limited release here in the States. The producer of the documentary is Mark Herbert on the line with us. Jeff Gordonier, New York Times staff writer, with me here in the studio. I guess I'll ask this question of both of you, but Mark, you first. You heard that last fan talking about, you know, you listen to the record when you get married and when people pass on, and, you know, when they started playing Made of Stone, I went to bits. Why was this such an unexpected event? What happened to make people think that this reunion would never happen?
Well, famously, and we cover it in the film, that publicly the band members said they would never reform. And you know, they were so badly managed in the early days. They were there was questions about money going missing. The deals he signed were completely ridiculous for the band, and there came a period where they were creatively, the juices were flowing, but they couldn't release any music because they were embroiled in a legal wrangling between record labels. It ended bitterly. It was a slow, painful end. And so I never thought that they would get back together, because publicly the people that were said they would never would.
Jeff, what about you? I mean, were you as taken aback by this reunion?
I think I'm taken aback by those comments we were hearing, because there's that, you know, that Wordsworth poem, I believe it's actually about the French Revolution, where he says it was bliss to be alive.
Mm.
And I think to be young was heaven. I'm misquoting it. But it you hear that in the voices of these people, which is that they're recalling that moment. Rock and roll, you know, to me in the end is about a moment or a few moments. I mean, I happen to remember seeing The Clash at the Hollywood Palladium in California when I was like 14. Some friends took me. And then I saw REM at the Hollywood Palladium a few years later when I think Reckoning was coming out. And, you know, to go back to that feeling.
Right.
I mean, nothing ever compared. I've seen many, many great performances since then, but nothing compared to the combustion and the romance of those moments. So that's what you're hearing in when these people talk about the Stone Roses. It's like, can I go back? Particularly, you know, as Mark is pointing out, because it ended bitterly. You don't want it to end bitterly. Can you put a, you know, a little sweetness on it at the end? Can you cap it in a more positive way?
Yeah. Do you, Jeff, have a favorite Stone Roses song?
I do. This is the one. I love that. I mean, I really love every single song on their signature album, The Stone Roses, including I Am the Resurrection, which is amazing. But there's something about the propulsion of the anthemic quality of This Is the One that you know, you just can't shake once you've heard it.
From their 1989 debut album, also called The Stone Roses. That is the band, The Stone Roses. This Is the One, the name of the song. Jeff Gordonier here with me in the studio. Mark Herbert, who produced the new documentary about The Stone Roses, with us on the line from the UK. Mark, the band had a reputation in their brief period as a touring band as a somewhat, let's say, eccentric live act. Jeff, would you agree?
Well, I wanted to ask Mark about that myself, because I never got a chance to see them live, and my only exposure essentially was the magic of YouTube.
YouTube, right.
Yeah, and you find all these weird clips on YouTube where they're like on a British TV show, they're performing, it sounds great, and suddenly they just stop. they just sort of like careen to a stop, and Ian gets surly and walks off, and John Squires looks like he wants to like throw his guitar or something, and you're like, what happened? And again, that's kind of transfixing. But Mark, what were they doing with some of those appearances?
I'm watching it like you. I'm like thinking, what happened? And you only what was it? There was a lovely contradiction between this kind of these performances, and you're seeing this stuff of this band that you know, they were young, they were adulate, you know. So who knows? I mean, I didn't know them then. But there was certainly an attitude. There was certainly, they certainly wouldn't take suffer fools gladly if things were going right. They would speak their mind. And I think there was a beautiful, I think that's why a lot of people identified with them as people. But what my experience of them on the film was, if you see the live stuff in the film, you know, this is why we put 35 cameras on that last section in Fool's Gold, in that we were amazed at how much effort and work and how good they sounded live. Mm. And I think that some of that stuff that you see them walking off, they're a weird band. If you take one element of the band out, they're not a band that you could suddenly replace the drummer. The drummer leaves, so you get another drummer in. Or the bass guitarist leaves, you get another. All four of them have this groove, and the way they practice, they look at each other, they're like in a diamond shape. So there's elements of Fool's Gold when, you know, the lead singer's just not even... Not singing for 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
he's just sat there, stood there, enjoying the three of them jam.
Stone Roses, from the documentary The Stone Roses Made of Stone, a little bit of Fool's Gold, which goes on and on.
It goes on and on. But it still works. You know, my 7-year-old son, I put that on recently, and he just loved it. I think he was twerking, actually. He just went crazy in the kitchen listening. It really grooves. It's a good song.
And there you hear one quartet of Northern Englishmen paying tribute to another. A little quote from the Beatles' Day Tripper there in that live performance. Now, Mark, you were saying before, you know, that this is a quartet that's more than the sum of its parts. You can't take the drummer out, replace the drummer, and expect them to still be the Stone Roses. But there is a moment in the middle of the tour in Europe when the drummer, Rennie, walks off stage and goes home, and the whole thing nearly collapses again. We don't see that coming. There's nothing that kind of leads up to that. Did you see it coming? Is there stuff behind the scenes that didn't make it into the film?
No. I mean, nobody knew this when it happened, but at the time he was getting the worst distortion and feedback in his ear. He had ear problems for days after that. He had tinnitus. You know, the distortion was unbearable. But of course, when it happened, I'm sat in the crowd, you know, behind the camera, just just sort of going, thinking, what a great gig they're going to do, you know, because it sounded great, but we didn't know. So when it happened, it was terrifying. I mean, we really thought that we were in trouble. We thought we were going to have to ring our finances to say, you know, the film, it's kind of an hour long.
But, you know, terrifying, again, that's just a rock and roll thing. I mean, these guys there's a kind of instability in terms of, you don't know what's going to happen.
And
you
unpredictability.
Talk to them. And you know, I actually interviewed the Stone Roses in New York City in the mid-90s for Entertainment Weekly when they were trying to make a comeback with Second Coming, or kind of trying to remind people that they existed. There was that charge in the air of like surliness, like it was a little scary. You didn't quite know what they'd say.
So, Jeff, do you have mixed feelings about the Stone Roses reunion?
No, I think it sounds great. I mean, look, I'm a Gen Xer, and we're supposedly, you know, sort of the more wary of nostalgia and the more wary of reunions and stuff, although everything we're doing here talking about this is nostalgic and our enthusiasm is coming through clear. But so, you know, the Pixies made a reunion. I couldn't believe that happened, and I was thrilled about it, and they sounded great. So it's like the proof is in the pudding. When you hear the Stone Roses, you hear the Pixies, you're like,
they still got it. Yeah.
They're fantastic. Why complain about this?
Well, you talk about, you know, we wanting to experience, to capture it. Well, Mark and his crew did exactly that with the documentary called The Stone Roses Made of Stone, available on DVD on December 3rd. Mark Herbert, the producer of that documentary, Jeff Gordonier here in the studio, New York Times staff writer. Guys, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, have you seen the Jeff Koons sculpture of Lady Gaga? It's Lady Gaga, so it's pop. It's Jeff Koons, so it's art. Put them together, and you have the cover of Art Pop, Gaga's new record. It just debuted at number one on the charts, and it's obviously got a big promotional push behind it. So why is everyone so disappointed? We'll hear about it next. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. After a 2.5-year hiatus since her last record, Born This Way, Lady Gaga recently released, or maybe I should say gave birth to, her latest album, Art Pop. But despite a heavy promotional push behind the new record, it hasn't performed as well as expected. Music and charts writer Chris Melanfi is here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Chris, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John.
And when I say, you know, giving birth to the record, I'm referring to the cover art by Jeff Koons, which shows her sort of giving birth to what looks like a big blue ball.
Yeah, and I believe it's a sculpture designed by Koons, which was prominently featured in her widely reported promotional event.
At the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
At the Brooklyn Navy Yard, exactly.
So here's this, like, well-known pop artist whose pieces auction for huge sums of money.
Right.
And he's done a sculpture of Lady Gaga, which gives you an idea of what's at stake here.
Yes, both in terms of the expense
yes.
and in terms of the concept of this record, because Lady Gaga has titled this record Art Pop, and she is very much trying to mash together the worlds of high art, or at least pop art in the case of Koons, and popular music. This is, of course, not a completely new trope for her. She's mined this before, but she's hitting it harder on this record than she has on previous records. And that may or may not explain why the record has caused some scratched heads since the promotional cycle for it began.
Now, are you saying people are scratching their heads because they're not sure what to make of the record, or because they're surprised by the somewhat middling response from the record-buying public?
I guess a little of both. I mean, you know, as you pointed out in your intro here, Gaga has been off the radar for a really long time, until basically the MTV Awards, when she, you know, debuted Applause, the single. It had hit radio a couple weeks earlier, so it wasn't the absolute first time people had heard it, but it was essentially the coming out party for Gaga. And it had been something of a tempestuous couple of years for her, and up to and including a hip injury, which
right.
forced her to cancel a large chunk of her last tour.
And to have surgery, right?
And have surgery. I mean, you know, if she, according to some stories that appeared over the summer, if she had done one or two more concerts, she might have needed a hip replacement.
Wow.
But nonetheless, she needed surgery. That took her off the road. And even before that, while she was still on the concert circuit, I double-checked this. She really literally was not on the charts at all for the entirety of 2012 and about half of 2013. So she had to really kind of restart the machine. There was a part of me that thought, when she kind of disappeared off the radar a year ago, that it was a smart move on her part, because she was so heavily exposed, that one might say overexposed, from about late 2008 till about, you know, late 2011. I mean, she was omnipresent. And I figured this was a smart move, you know, get off the radar, make people miss you a little bit.
There's an old country song. How can I miss you
if you
never
go away? Exactly. So that, I think, was a relatively smart move. But, you know, getting the gears of the pop machine going again is a tough challenge, as we see. I would say that this debut, which is way off from her last debut, and we can talk numbers in a minute, is not entirely shocking, but it must come as a jaw-dropper to people who remember the kind of number she was rolling a couple of years ago.
All right. We are talking about an album that debuted at number one.
Of course, yes. So let's put that in perspective. We're still talking about a woman who's got a number one album this week.
She sold just over 250,000 copies.
That's right. The official number is 258,000. Now, to give you all some perspective, we've seen this is the season of the pop diva. We've had new number one albums by several of the big pop stars that, you know, we all take for granted on the radio these days. Katy Perry. The two I would point to are Katy Perry and Miley Cyrus. Katy Perry debuted with her latest album Prism about a month and a half ago with 286,000 copies. And Miley Cyrus debuted right around the same time with 270,000 copies. So Gaga is right in that zone one might expect a, you know, pop star with her kind of profile to have. That's the positive spin on this number. It's a little off from those two numbers, but, you know, not completely out of the ballpark.
All right. We're speaking with Chris Milanfi, music critic and charts writer, writes for NPR Music and Pitchfork, and joins us occasionally on Soundcheck. We'll parse some of these numbers in a moment, but let's hear one of the new singles from the album Art Pop by Lady Gaga. This one is in the top 10, and it's called Dope.
Quirks off, it's on. The party's just begun. I promise this. Drink is my last one. I know I've messed up again. 'Cause I lost my only friend. God forgive my sins. Don't.
The song from Lady Gaga. It is not the only reference to weed on this album, Art Pop.
No, it is not.
But this, I mean, most of the record, Chris, has that kind of four on the floor, that relentless dance groove to it. What is this song doing in the top 10?
Okay, that's a great question, and there's a technical reason for that. Gaga performed this song on the YouTube Music Awards a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
I guess it was just called the YouTube Awards, although you'd be forgiven for thinking it was the YouTube Music Awards given the sheer number of music artists who were on it. And this performance of Dope, which was just her doing a heart-rending rendition, she literally cried a bit, was watched by hundreds of thousands of YouTube viewers. Now, as you may recall, and we've talked about this on the air before, in our brave new world of the Hot 100 on Billboard's flagship chart, YouTube views actually count for the chart. And this was a bit of a judgment call by Billboard, but they decided to count views by viewers of the YouTube Music Awards of that Dope performance toward the chart. And as a result, Dope debuted in the top 10, all the way up at number 8. And as I'm sitting here looking at the chart, they Billboard reveals that 95% of the points that caused Dope to appear in the top 10 came from the YouTube Music Awards.
So those YouTube Awards, what they did after the live webcast
right.
was they broke them up so you could watch
exactly.
one song. So it's not like every performance from the YouTube Awards is in the top 10.
Correct. But and Dope, you know, it was quite a buzzy performance. So even after the YouTube mm-hmm. Awards appeared live, a lot of people were going back to watch that Dope performance.
Okay, so we're talking about Lady Gaga's new record, Art Pop, debuts at number 1 on the Billboard 200 with sales of 258,000 copies, a little less than Miley Cyrus, a little less than Katy Perry,
right.
a lot less than the previous Lady Gaga record, which debuted with 1.1 million copies in its first week. But again, there's an explanation for that.
Yeah. This was back in May of 2011. And for 2 days during its debut week, Amazon.com, which then was fairly new in the MP3 selling business, as a move to boost its MP3 selling business, they put Born This Way, the full album, on sale for 99 cents for just 2 days of the tracking week. It was estimated by Billboard that sales of that 99-cent version accounted for something like 400,000 to 450,000 copies of the 1.1 million. Now, whenever I talk about this, I like to put it in perspective because that still means that about 600,000 to 700,000 people bought the album at full price.
Right.
Not only would the record have been number one without these 99-cent sales, it would have been number one by a country mile.
Right.
And I would even go so far as to argue that of that 400,000, one can't prove that all 400,000 people wouldn't have bought the album if it hadn't been available for 99 cents.
All right. So whatever the asterisk might mean, there we still have a real juggernaut of a record.
Totally.
And now with Art Pop, considerably, just a fraction of that in terms of sales so far. How worried are the folks at her label, Interscope? Shouldn't they have seen this coming?
I think they're probably somewhat worried, but I agree with you that they probably saw it coming. Response to Applause, the first single, was respectful and solid, but much more tepid. To give some perspective, the last album, Born This Way, its title track was the lead-off single. That song debuted on the Hot 100 at number one. Not just number one in radio, not just number one in sales, number one on the whole chart, which shows what a cultural juggernaut, to use your word, Gaga was back in 2011. I often say that the first week of any project by a pop act, a single, an album, is a referendum on what the artist did last.
This is your AC/DC rule.
This is a little theory. I wrote about this for NPR earlier this year, and we got a lot of chatter going about this. I called it the AC/DC rule because AC/DC's biggest album of all time is Back in Black. It peaked at number four, and it sold something like 22 million copies. The album after Back in Black, for those about to rock, We Salute You, was their first number one album for a long time, their only number one album, and it sold literally one-sixth as many copies, but it went to number one. This is a pretty typical chart pattern. You see that what happens is after somebody has a slow-building hit, the next thing is what goes to number one. This has happened time and time again, and it happened to Gaga.
Well, it happened with Born This Way, right? Because
exactly.
That went straight to number one after The Fame and The Fame Monster.
The Fame and The Fame Monster popped around the charts, never hitting number one for the better part of 2 years.
Yeah.
She never had a week over, I want to say, maybe 200,000, 300,000 copies, and that was at Christmas. Most weeks, the album would sell, 40,000 here, 50,000 there.
Mm-hmm.
But that buildup and all those radio hits she had in 2009 and 2010, by the time Born This Way came out, people were primed to buy that record.
So what's happened this time?
I would say the AC/DC rule has struck again. I would say that Born This Way, while mostly acclaimed, it was generally a stranger record. It spawned fewer hits. I think people who bought it probably didn't play it as much as The Fame. And so you have to regard Art Pop as living in the shadow of Born This Way. So couple that with the long period that she was away and, the troubles she's had and so forth. And I just think this was a tough sell going in.
Now, have you heard these rumors that, again, her label, Interscope, spent something like $25 million on a promotional campaign? What do you make of that?
First of all, the sourcing on that is a little fishy. I've noticed that several newspapers and magazines have picked it up in the last 24 hours, but some are already starting to distance it because nobody's got a great source on that. It's entirely possible that Interscope is quaking in its boots and did spend too much money on this, and goodness knows the Brooklyn Navy Yard event, there was a lot of chatter. Wow, this thing must have been expensive. There are some obvious signs that they did spend a lot to promote this record. But I would argue if you're at Interscope going in 2 months ago, you had to know this record was going to have a much more, let's say, earthbound number when it debuted. Like a number one debut was probably a foregone conclusion, but a number in the quarter million range was closer to reality than the 1.1 million she rolled in 2011.
All right. Now, she both hosted and was the musical guest on Saturday Night Live.
That's right.
There is often a Saturday Night Live bump.
Yep.
Will she, with a record that has debuted at number one, is there room for a bump next
week? Well, in effect, she's probably already had a big chunk of the bump because what happens is Billboard's tracking week runs from Monday to Sunday.
Yeah.
So Saturday Night Live happens, in the wee hours of Saturday. And if people, and now in the digital era, if you're turned on by something you see, you can buy it instantly.
Right,
we often see that the Grammys, for example, which is a Sunday night telecast often, you get hits of sales instantly. So Gaga may have already had her bump. It's entirely possible that there'll be some slower moving consumers who this week after Saturday Night Live are going and picking up the record. But odds are she got a big chunk of her bump already.
All right. Well, the album is called Art Pop, the latest from Lady Gaga, the number one album in the country right now with sales numbers that would be perfectly fine for most other people. Maybe not what Gaga and her crew had hoped for. We've been speaking with Chris Melanfi, who writes about the charts, is a music critic for NPR Music and Pitchfork. And on Saturday Night Live, she performed this song, Do What You Want, with R. Kelly.
Yep. This is my favorite track, I think.
From the record?
Yeah, catchy as heck.
Do What You Want is the song from Lady Gaga. Up next, an Australian producer and musician who calls himself Chet Faker is breathing new life into an R&B hit from the 90s. We'll hear about it, and we'll hear from Chet Faker and some of his original compositions in our studio next. This is Soundcheck.
Shutting it down, good luck. Baby, got them open all over town. Stick the biz, don't play around. Cover much ground, got game by the pound. Getting paid is a forte.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Back in 1996, this song by the R&B group Blackstreet hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100, ending the Macarena's all-too-long reign at the top of the charts. And since then, the song's been covered many times, but this particular version actually launched an entire career. It's from the Australian producer and singer known as Chet Faker, and he's here with us in the studio today. We'll talk with him in a moment. But first, here he is to play one of his original songs called Love and Feeling. It's Chet Faker, live on Soundcheck.
Take it off my mind. Old enough to make you mine. I believe in human rights. Got to take it off my mind, off my mind. But now you've got me here to win. I see through the innocence. I know the way is getting hard. Holding line, a way to live, and music keeps me spirited, but nothing can compare the way. You know, you got me with the love and feeling, and I know my body cares only what you say, and you know. You got me with the love and feeling, and I know my body cares only what you say. Old enough to see you fine, driving circles in my mind. Got to keep it all in line, all in line. Scribing words to make you fold, make you hear so you want more. Got to keep it all in line, all in line. But now you know, the less you give, the more I pull, the more I wish. Rapacious from the very start. But I hold in line a way to live, and you come close a little bit. Now everything, it seems okay. And you know, you got me with the love and feeling, and I know my body cares only what you say. You know, you got me with the love and feeling. I know my body cares only what you say. And you know, oh, oh, love and feeling. And I know only what you say. And you know, oh, I know
That is Chet Faker, the work of Australian singer and producer Nick Murphy, records under the name Chet Faker and has released a debut EP called Thinking in Textures. That song is called Love and Feeling, playing live here in the studio. Chet/Nick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
Chet Faker, clever name. Were you a fan of the jazz trumpeter and singer?
Chet I was, Baker? Yes, but perhaps not a big enough fan in retrospect. Had I known that I'd be sporting this name around the world.
Well, we just last week had a conversation with Bruce Weber, who did this amazing, maybe you've seen it, the documentary Let's Get Lost, mm-hmm. About Chet Baker in his last kind of dissolute years. How well known was he known in Australia? Do people get the reference down under?
No, maybe not. I mean, you know, I guess it's the same here in the States. A lot of people would, but it's a generational thing, I think.
Yeah.
Some of the younger people, I mean, I've met people who think No Diggity is an original by me, which is...
Because it's so old.
I know.
From the mid-90s.
What's happening?
Yeah. So the name Chet Faker, was this just sort of a spur-of-the-moment decision?
It was somewhere in between that. I mean, Nick Murphy is my birth name, but there's another Nick Murphy from the same town that I'm from, Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And he already had 3 albums out. And when I started this project, I didn't have, like, grand dreams for it at all. And I used to play under my name, and then people would show up at the shows and be like, who the hell is this? So at the time, I was listening to a lot of Chet Baker, and I particularly liked the way he undersold his vocal.
Yeah.
And then Faker was just like a tongue-in-cheek. It's like, well, that's not my name, is it?
Well, you know, there's a singer out of Philadelphia named Kurt Vile.
Yeah,
except
I know
he spells
Kurt Vile.
It V-I-L-E. So, you know, some of the old guys from the mid-20th century getting...
it's happening.
Yeah, they're getting a little bit of a shout-out in the modern scene. So Chet Faker is the name that Nick Murphy uses. I mentioned the debut EP is called Thinking in Textures. Now, you've got something upcoming called the Lockjaw EP as well.
That's right.
With Flume,
mm-hmm.
Who's another Australian producer. As a producer yourself... you're here today kind of surrounded by electronics and stuff, and it seems like you're doing more than just pressing go and singing along. You're actually able to kind of manipulate some of those electronics in a live setting, right?
Yeah, I mean, it comes at a loss. It's really easy these days to just have that kind of, you know, your backing, and your show is going to be amazing every time, but the variation is going to be absolutely minimal,
right?
Because you've got this same show. And I guess I originally came from a performance background. I used to play in bands, and I used to sing, and I used to play keys and all that. So I started to miss that. I started to miss being able to mess the whole show up.
Mm-hmm.
So this
not that you want to mess it up, but you want to know that that's a possibility.
Yeah, sometimes it's not so bad, you know. With these days, everything can be like so perfect.
Yeah.
I think it helps you connect with someone if someone makes a mistake every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, with this setup, I can screw everything up, or I can kill it.
Chet Faker performing live here in the Soundcheck studio. Once again, his debut EP is called Thinking in Textures. Here he is, though, live in our studio at our Steinway piano. And he's going to play a song for us the old-fashioned way. This one's called I'm Into You. Thank you.
eyes make it perfect, and your eyes can make me swim. Then again, everything seems new. I can barely hold my tongue, to say the least, I'm into you. And your eyes are saying more than we can talk, and warmer than the bedroom spot. And your thighs are kisses from the outside, girl, that's all I need. Take you down the other road to breathing something more. I find it harder to ignore the things I want you for. I know you don't want a love you can sing. The music was at the start. So I needed to hear a woman could sweep my heart. Pressing near up to your breast, I can hear the rhythm start. It's hard to tell our beats apart, so I hope you're listening right now. 'Cause I can barely hold my tongue, we do could warm the sun. And I twisted in a melting fall and sleeping with the scratching claws. And your words let me know you're feeling me and seeing all the things I see. I'll take you down the other road to breathe in something more. I find it harder to ignore the things I want you for. I know you don't want a love you can sing. The music was at the start. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. The rhythm was old. I needed to hear a woman could treat my heart. At the start, do 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 do. The room was old, needed to hear a woman could treat my heart. Do 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 do.
The song is called I'm Into You, live performance at our piano from Chet Faker. The latest EP, the debut from Chet Faker, is called Thinking in Textures. The upcoming one is called the Lockjaw EP, coming out later this month. The full length will be next year sometime?
Early next year.
All right. Chet Faker with us here in the Soundcheck studio. It's been good having you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Greetings on the lady. It's on the bone. Greed is on the lady. Oh, it's time to fall. Naked on the bedroom. We died alone. Breathing on my baby. Oh, it's not my fault. It's not the money. It's not our fault. fault. Naked on the bedroom wall, I should have known.
You can hear another song from our session with Chet Baker. Just head over to our website, soundcheck.org, where nearly every day at 2 p.m. we stream a live performance. Get the latest updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter. Tomorrow on the show, a deep dive into the Beatles song I Wanna Hold Your Hand. Beatle biographer Alan Kozin joins us to talk about that song, the subject of his new ebook. And live music from Rubble Bucket and a Soundcheck Smackdown on the Sound of Music. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop and Mike Katziff, with Isaac Davey Aronson, Amy Pearl, and our intern, Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.